May it please the court, I'm Robert Stenshorn. I represent Dwayne Diggs. Mr. Diggs was convicted of 18-2-178, larceny by false pretense. It's a fundamental due process right to have notice for the crimes that you have to defend and you'll be tried upon. Mr. Diggs was denied this opportunity to properly prepare for the Commonwealth's claims. His conviction for larceny by fraud should be...
If I might interrupt, the bottom line is that who the victim is.
Exactly, Judge Frank.
That controls this whole case.
Absolutely. I think what's instructive, Judge Frank, on that is if we look at page 3 and 4 of the record, in that, you see in the criminal complaint, it's clearly specifying only that Mr. Diggs took his vehicle to have warranty repairs performed at Hall Ford. It specifically says to Hall Ford. Yet the indictment that came back as a true bill, it says that from Hall Ford. It's changed the nature of the crime that he's being accused of a warranty fraud against the warrantor, who was Ford Motor Company, to a theft from Hall Ford.
Well, and how is this case not controlled by the Supreme Court's decision in Quigley? Because JCPenney seems to me to be, and Quigley seems to be in the exact position as Hall Ford here.
Your Honor, actually, Quigley was a case that really can be contrasted from this. In Quigley, which was a 1981 case, this was a document that actually arose out of Norfolk. A person in social services fraudulently wrote out a voucher for some benefits that were, clothing after an emergency that came from JCPenney. The focus there was not upon the intent, because the intent was clearly proven by the fact that she forged the documents. She pretended to be the person to whom the benefit was to be given.
Given that the trier of fact was able to accept the officer's testimony that your client said, I rolled back the odometer to get the repairs done under warranty, do we have any question of intent here?
Your Honor, actually, when we talk more on the sufficiency of the evidence, one of the things that the investigator was unclear about was what he was exactly admitting to. Under cross-examination, and I believe the best spot in the record on that is going to be at 162. What it ended up being was that Mr. Diggs said he would take responsibility for it, not that he did it. And the other problem with that particular statement is that this particular type of automobile doesn't have a mechanical odometer that you can roll back. It's a computer, and there's certain components that are keyed into that computer. And it's not simply like you used to do when you could mechanically manipulate an odometer. That's why the odometer tampering charge that was a sister allegation to this was dropped in Nalpras, because it was unsupportable, because you can't roll that car back. But back to your question on Quigley. Quigley was determined without Judge McCullough's excellent work later in Knuckles, and as well as under the guidance of Gardner and Etheridge. This court said, we're going to draw a very bright line. If there's any variance in the indictment, it's fatal. When it went up to the Supreme Court, what it says, if it's surplusage, it can go by. But if it's critical to the name of the victim and the specifics of the charge, we can't overlook it, and it's a fatal variance.
But if there's no variance, those cases don't apply.
If there's no variance, Judge Frank, correct. But in this case, there is a variance. Judge?
Well, there's no one here who's a bigger admirer of Judge McCullough's fine work than I am. I would note that whatever he says can't overturn a Supreme Court case, Quigley. And so whether the Supreme Court had the benefit of it or not, Quigley is what controls, not what Judge McCullough.
Judge, I respect that, but I would argue that Knuckles overturned Quigley. In Quigley, they were looking at the intent of the young lady who forged the voucher. In this particular case, and in Knuckles, what we're looking at, in Knuckles, it was an issue of whether the form of the business was correct. Breeden Mechanical, Inc. versus Breeden Mechanical, a trade name or sole proprietorship. And the form of the corporation was seen as surplusage, and so when it overturned this court, the Virginia Supreme Court said, we'll allow that. The line is not quite that bright. And in this case, you have Hall Ford, who is simply a mechanical repair organization, versus the warranty itself, which is given by Ford Motor Company.
Let's go back for a minute. It seems that the thrust of your argument is Hall Ford can't be the victim because they never sustained any loss.
That's tangentially correct, Your Honor.
But that's not the law, is it?
No, the law is...
The labor and the parts were owned by Hall Ford, right?
Correct.
And they released the car after the work was done to this appellant. Whether or not they were reimbursed under Quidley makes no difference, does it?
Not to that aspect of it, Judge Frank, but if what the real gist of this is, it's a fraud at the point that he took the vehicle in for warranty service. And that warranty service is solely within the province of Ford Motor Company.
Well, then, so this is the perfect crime. He only makes representations to Hall Ford, so if he can't defraud them because the warranty is going to be paid by Ford Motor Company, he makes no representations to an actual employee of Ford.
Judge, I'm not going to concede that he made any false representations.
Assuming he did.
If that was correct, I could see your logic there. However, in our 18-2-178, it requires both a fraudulent act and an intent to use that fraudulent act to obtain the property of another.
And so if the trial court believed the statement of the officer and credited it, that your client confessed that he rolled back the odometer and did it to obtain warranty, we have those two elements, do we not?
We have that. That severely hurts me on the sufficiency of the evidence, but I believe as far as the warrant itself in the indictment, I think that I am going to be able to illustrate the fatal flaw, because Hall Ford, and in the testimony by Cassie Veronis, the service manager there, Hall Ford never presented Mr. Diggs with a bill for this. It was a transaction between the owner of the vehicle and Ford Motor Company, who provides the warranty. And that's really the issue there. Had the indictment specified that it was a warranty fraud or that it had been provided by Ford Motor Company, I wouldn't have that argument today.
You indicated that you think that Quidley may have been at least implicitly overruled. I take it it's never been explicitly overruled. I know, for instance, you rely on Gardner, but Gardner makes clear it is not overruling Quidley. In fact, it claims to be applying Quidley.
But the court in Quidley didn't have the benefit of those cases that came up and said specifically what was surplusage versus what was important to maintain in the charging documents. And I think that's the distinction, Your Honor.
But you're not aware of any time the Supreme Court has said we overrule our holding in Quidley?
No, Your Honor. And in Quidley, the point was that there had been no loss by the department store, because the fraud happened on the front end of it. The voucher was a real voucher that was issued to a fictional person with a Ford signature of an officer from the Social Services Division.
So if we conclude that intentionally rolling back the odometer is no different than preparing the forged document, you would concede you lose?
I would say I'm considerably weakened. I'm not going to concede that because, Your Honor, the record doesn't contain any knowledge about how the odometer was rolled back or at what point in time.
If the trial court believed that he confessed to it, does it matter that there's no explanation of how he did it if he, in fact, confessed to it and the trial court believed that?
Judge, you've got me in a tough position where I think only 5A18A helps me at that point, because the real issue here, when we look at my second issue on the sufficiency of the evidence, you don't have any time in where the pinpoint is said where this vehicle had a mileage change, whether it happened before Quality Van Service, the owner of the vehicle at the time that the service was requested, under the time of a prior owner who had a considerable amount of miles on it, or if it happened somewhere in between, or after the fact that this particular car was prevented for service. Mr. Diggs didn't own the car. Mr. Diggs didn't have a possessory interest in the car. He was simply taking it in for a pre-purchased inspection by the dealership.
But it doesn't matter when it occurred, as so long as he's the one who did it and did it knowing he did it to get under the warranty. Even if he didn't reduce it to $49,000 or whatever it was on the actual odometer, if 6 months earlier he said, I know I'm going to need this repair at some point, and reduced it to 25,000 miles and drove it like crazy, or somebody else drove it like crazy, if the trial court believes the testimony from the officer that he admitted to doing it and did it for this purpose, how is that not sufficient to establish that he tried to fraudulently obtain the goods and services?
Your Honor, in Hairston, the court recognized that the facts and circumstances of each of these types of cases is going to be different. Here, what the problem is the intent. If Mr. Diggs tendered that car intentionally trying to get warranty service and intentionally having altered the car, I think you would have me conceding and you would have put me firmly in the corner. However, here the record says that Mr. Diggs was unaware that there was a need for emissions control repair on this car. The record contains facts that Ford Motor Company has an 8-year, 80,000-mile warranty. The 8 years hadn't expired on this car yet. Only Ford Motor Company is in control of the terms of that warranty. If there is no warranty fraud, there is no 18.2178 factor here. What we have is a civil dispute between perhaps Hall Ford and Quality Van Service, the owner of the vehicle. The record says that Ms. Veronis, I think, said it clearly, that the client never sees the warranty work. That's done in the background. They and Mr. McAchin, the actual person who saw Mr. Diggs and saw the vehicle, says that that wasn't brought in for that, that the vehicle was diagnosed because of a red light on the dashboard, and that replacing the emissions control, which is something that's done frequently in the car business, was done to correct that. That's a huge failure on a particular car, and we don't know if Ford Motor Company may have done that out of goodwill or just customer service. Those records are there, and they do say that exceptions have been made to the warranty in the past. They also say, Ms. Veronis puts out, that Mr. Diggs was never told exactly what the process was, that he showed up, or somebody showed up, paid the vehicle's repairs, about $500, for the things that he had asked to be done when he brought it in, the known defects in the car, and that this warranty issue had to have been known at the point that the odometer was rolled back and presented specifically for service. Your Honor, if there's no further questions, I'll respond to Ms. Bourne.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth. There was no fatal variance here because the correct victim, Hall Ford, was named in the indictment, and the evidence presented at trial proved that Hall Ford was, in fact, the victim here, who the parts belonged to Hall Ford, and that was established by the testimony at trial. The parts did not belong to Ford Motor Company. And so when Hall Ford put the parts into the vehicle, the fact that they may have had a debtor, creditor, or claim, or some other relationship with Ford Motor Company, where they believe that they would later become reimbursed, is irrelevant. The question here is, who was the victim at the time the false representation was made and the vehicle was returned to Mr. Diggs, and in fact, Paul Ford was the victim at that time. So the reimbursement was irrelevant. The larceny was complete when the vehicle was returned. Both the indictment and the evidence correctly identified Hall Ford. And there was testimony that Ford Motor Company, the practice was to only resubmit the bill to Ford Motor Company after the vehicle has been returned and there haven't been any complaints about the service that's been performed. So there was no fatal variance in this case. I would note that it doesn't matter what the criminal complaint says. When we're talking about fatal variance, we're talking about fatal variance between the indictment and the evidence presented at trial. So whether there was some other owner noted in the criminal complaint is irrelevant to a fatal variance question. So with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, there were a number of arguments put forward. And I would just note on the previous issue, Quigley is a controlling case in this matter. On the evidence sufficiency, the first argument that he made was that Hall Ford submitted the warranty on its own.
Is there any tension between our decisions and the Supreme Court on this point?
I don't think with regard to this case, I mean, you know, this isn't, I would argue that Gardner does not support his position. Because
we heard some argument earlier about Court of Appeals and Supreme Court and who's overruling whom, but I thought there was a consistent stream of decisions on this point.
Well, that's my interpretation of it. I don't think Gardner supports his position. I think Gardner,
in order to have a fatal variance, there has to be a variance in the first place.
That's correct. There's no variance in this case at all. The correct victim, he may believe that it should be a different victim, but the correct victim was named. Under the law, that's the victim at the time, and that was what the evidence proved. So there was no variance. There was no other victim under the law, and there was no fatal variance. He has advanced several challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence on brief. Briefly, I think the first argument is that Hall Ford submitted the warranty claim on its own initiative. Well, of course, that ignores the fact that he actually brought the vehicle in for warranty service and confessed that later on, that he brought the vehicle in order to have warranty service done and had rolled back the odometer in order to receive those parts and services he wasn't entitled to. His second argument is that he didn't own the vehicle. Of course, that isn't dispositive in a larceny case. You don't have to own the vehicle. He didn't have to own the vehicle. It's sufficient that he deprived somebody else of their property for his own benefit, and he was using the vehicle after the fact. He admitted it was his. He had the benefit of using it in its repaired state, and he was still driving it several months later when he met with the DMV officer. He argues that he didn't have an intent to defraud, and I would argue that his statement is sufficient to show that he had an intent to defraud, and that's not every element has to be corroborated, only slight corroboration. And here there was slight corroboration in that the vehicle previously had one mileage when it had been repaired, and now it has a different mileage, and he confessed that he was the one who rolled the odometer back. And if the court doesn't have any other questions for me, I would just ask that you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your argument.
Your Honors, I'd like to call the court's attention to page 162 of the record. Special Agent was asking, well, we asked him, you know, how did the mileage get changed? We asked him if his wife had done it, and he said no. We've asked if anybody else had done it. He said no, that he had done it and would take personal responsibility for any charges that came out of this. This is a coercion to protect his wife, is what's being relayed into a confession. Even if Mr. Diggs had knowledge...
Isn't that a factual argument that the fact finder has to resolve?
I'm sorry, Judge Frank?
Isn't that a factual, the fact whether that statement is coerced? Isn't that for the fact finder to determine, not an appellate court?
Your Honor, I say it coerced not in the form that it was an improper confession or testimony. I'm saying it in the way that it was drawn out of Mr. Diggs out of concern for his wife. His wife has an administrative position that requires a motor vehicle dealer board license, and that was their sole source of income at the time. Mr. Diggs was unemployed. That's why, in response to Ms. Bourne's comment, he was driving his father-in-law's prospective vehicle sometimes later after he had purchased the vehicle, about 4 months after this event. But back to where I should be.
I think Judge Frank's point is that testimony was before the trier of fact. The argument could have been made at the trial court that it was coerced, the very argument you're making, and the trial court rejected it.
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree that the sufficiency of the evidence is my weakest position. Back to the fatal variance, though, what's important about this is the intent that existed. Even if Mr. Diggs knew the mileage wasn't appropriate, if he went into that dealership to pay for his services, get the work done that he asked for, there's no variance in what he did. The intent has to be there when he took the vehicle in to get the services performed. I think the record's clear. He didn't know what was needed at that point. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I'll thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we'll come down to Greek Council.